Session number 13522.
O'Brien Reel 3.
As we're moving up the hill, I was just explaining, our training did us in good stead, because by going to ground and moving and picking our targets, we suffered a lot less casualties than our American friends did. This continued on for another hill until suddenly we got called to get back down to the road. By the road is by back down to where the convoy was. The convoy in the meantime had been slowly moving along as we cleared the ground of the enemy. What we did not know at that time as individuals was that a plane had spotted from the air what appeared to be a black mass in the snow was actually thousands of Chinese moving along on foot towards the convoy. This sounds an impossible situation, but this is literally what it was. We did not know as individuals, because the only orders we got was to move back down to the road as quick as possible. We then got onto the vehicles, and I'll use a military term, they were thin-skinned vehicles, if you understand what I mean, which meant they had canvas tops in some cases. We, in the Royal Marine section, or where our vehicles were, we had taken all the canvas tops off, because our routine was, if a truck came under fire, then you just spilled out and went to ground, whereas if you're in a vehicle with a canvas top on, you can only get out one end and you're going to get trapped. So all our vehicles, we'd taken the canvas tops off. We started to move along, and as what happened was, the commanding officer, Colonel Drysdale, had received a message from Hagaru Rhee for us to get through, because they were being severely attacked at Hagaru and almost being overrun by the Chinese there. So our orders were to get through to Hagaru at all costs, regardless of casualties, because we were needed at Hagaru to boost up the perimeter defence. By we, I mean 41 Independent Commando, George Company of the American Marines, and this company of Army chaps. Altogether, we were about 900 strong. And we had, as I said, 17 tanks. And so, this was the situation on the 29th of November, as we went into the afternoon. Now, the weather had dropped to 20 degrees below freezing. On top of that, the Chinese had moved in so close over the hills that you could see them mashing down the hillside. And it was getting dark, because the winter closed in very quickly. Bearing in mind, we're up in North Korea now. And at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, it was almost dark. And we came under constant fire attack. Our task was to get through. And so we were trying to get through with the vehicles, at the same time firing across at all these Chinese who were firing at us. There was mortars coming down. There were small arms weapons being fired. There was machine guns being fired. And we were really suffering casualties very hard. We fired back from the trucks as we went along. You look back now, it's like the cowboys and Indian days with a stagecoach going along, but it wasn't funny at the time. We got stopped quite a few times. The truck ahead or somewhere farther ahead would get hit, and that would stop. The driver killed, people on it killed, and so all the other trucks would stop, because this road was so narrow you just could not get by. And you've got a sheer drop on one side and ditches, etc., on the other, and going up into the mountains where the Chinese were swarming on. Most of the attack was coming from our right-hand side. So we knew that once we had to leap off a vehicle, we would leap off to the left. And as a truck was hit, as soon as our truck stopped, we all leaped off and were firing across the road at the Chinese. They were heaving grenades. Our chaps were getting killed. I saw chaps being blown apart. You see his head just go, you know. And our company commander, Captain Parkinson, combined. A truck was hit another time as we jumped back on and were moving off, and it started to burn. And he leaped onto the running board and grabbed hold of the steering wheel, because the driver had been killed, and he shouted to us, "All push, lads." And we pushed it off the road, and it started to trundle down to the left, down the hillside. And I heard him shout back to the road, because he was a very, very forceful man. He's an officer. He got the military cross in World War II. And we went back to the road and scrambled back down and were firing back across at the figures that you could see in the darkness. And this explosion went up, and it was the truck with some ammunition on it exploding and burning. We never saw a company commander after that. He was reported missing, as we presumed killed, and eventually declared killed, and never ever found. So things like that, whereby, to my mind, you know, he saved so many lives, and this is where awards should be made, but they don't. We then had to carry on, and if you can understand a lot of trucks, we were getting chopped up like a snake being chopped up into a lot of little pieces, and each one then was having to fend for itself or else get on. This went on like this with everything happening around us. I can't really put into words the noise of attack. I can remember us singing. I remember a group of us singing "Where a Shower of Bastards," you know, that song, if you excuse my wording. But at the same time, we're firing our guns, because the Chinese were so close, you could see them running and darting everywhere and falling down. And the noise of them, they're blowing bugles, they're shouting and screaming, because it's the noise of battle. Your mates shouting out, you know, as they've been hit, and they're screaming out. They don't sort of just say, "I'm okay, you know, I'm wounded," like you see in the films. They're screaming out that they're hurt. And this went on right through the evening. And by the time we got through to Agaru, I was one of the very fortunate ones. I think about 3 or 4 trucks out of 100 got through. The rest were burnt and damaged, and just all the drivers killed. Out of 900 of us that got through, about half of George Company got there. Not many of the Army chaps, American Army chaps, got there. And 97 of us Royal Marines got there. And so out of 900, about 450. So good of us got through to Agaru that night. So if you can understand, it's not like an atom bomb dropping. This is hand-to-hand fighting, and you literally fighting for your life, and you're killing a chap who's right opposite you, which is, to me, as a young 18-year-old, I'd never seen anything different to this, and I thought this is what all wars are like, you know, not being able to compare it with anything else. I can remember when we got to Hagaru, we drove through a perimeter defence and there was machine guns and everything firing there that night. It was a mass of light. And no sooner we were inside this perimeter, which you cannot see, you don't see a set perimeter. There were just pockets of people in the dark firing out at all of the Chinese who were attacking. And inside this perimeter, which must have been about 5 or 6 miles around, or maybe a bit more, where those thousands of Americans were all surrounded, inside there was this place called Hagaru, which is an old shack village of the North Korean type, you know, which is sort of mud and wattle made sort of thing, with a couple of brick buildings. The Americans were building a makeshift airstrip, and they had bulldozers, arc lights. It was as though you were in the middle of Times Square, with all these lights and noises and people working and so forth, while on the outside there was all the fighting going on. It was unbelievable, because the Americans were carrying on as though there was nothing wrong whatsoever, whilst a few hundred yards away there was the Americans defending the perimeter and fighting for their lives and being overrun. And yet these other Americans were using bulldozers and had cigars stuck in their mouths. It is the most unbelievable thing you can imagine. What they were doing was building a makeshift airstrip, and these planes were coming in. They were loading on all the casualties and flying them out. At that time, there was very, very few helicopters. Just a few helicopters that we actually saw were the type which you see in MASH, you know, that program on television. They were the only type of helicopters that they had in Korea, because helicopters hadn't been brought into the use of which they're used today. You still depended on aircraft to do airdrops, paratroops to drop by parachute, and the ground forces to move up on vehicles. And the few helicopters that were there were being used to fly out casualties, exactly like you see on MASH. And so, as it got light the next morning, we regrouped ourselves by literally walking around, trying to find out how many of us were sort of still left, sort of thing, and joining up with the other Royal Marines, because during that afternoon and night you just got completely separated. You'd end up one particular time, like I remember, you jumped off a vehicle and we were firing back across the road at the Chinese, and there was a couple of Americans that jumped off another vehicle, so the next time a vehicle come along we just jump on it as it's moving, and you've got 5 Americans and 2 Marines, you know, and your concept of a group, of a section of Royal Marines is gone, because you don't know whether they've been laying there killed in the dark or whether they managed to jump on another truck, because our orders were, get on any truck that's moving, we've got to get through to save those at Hagaru. Save them. We were in a bit of a problem ourselves. Nevertheless, we got through, and the next morning when it was light, we started to regroup ourselves. And we became known as reserve troops to boost up any attack on any part of the perimeter should it be in danger of being overrun. Now, by this time, our troop, which was known as Baker Troop, I was a rifleman in Baker Troop, we had got ourselves reorganised pretty quickly, along with the other Marines who found their sort of sections, etc. And Colonel Drysdale came along and he put Lieutenant Roberts in charge of our troop, because Captain Parkins in command, as far as we knew, had been killed. He'd just been blown up. So we had no company commander, and Lieutenant Roberts was put in charge. And we numbered then about about 32 men in Baker Troop. We'd lost a few, but we were pretty well organised. We got ourselves a meal by queuing up, and this is the situation. If you can imagine, the Americans in this area, which has been flattened by warfare, whereby tanks are just flattened, flimsy wooden buildings, and there was bits of rubble lying everywhere. There's fires being lit everywhere where people were getting warm because it was 20 degrees or more below freezing. So literally you were freezing. And people were trying to keep warm. And I can remember queuing up in a chow line, as you get to call it if you're with the Americans. And chaps were getting shot in the chow line by a sniper. And another chap was in a toilet, which was just a little wooden place they decided to use for a toilet, and it was pitted with bullet holes where snipers had been getting them in as they went in the toilet. And the Americans were still going in there to the toilet, like, you know. And suddenly we found where this sniper was firing from in the rubble in one of the buildings, and a tank came up and just went back and forth over it, and it came running out, and it just flattened him. It just splattered. You know, and when the tank moved on, there was an imprint of him in the snow, of well, much like the jokey things of a steamroller going over something, like, you know, and it was, you just carried on eating your you know, chew. Oh, well, that's got rid of that one, sort of thing. You became very hardened all of a sudden. I'm not saying that anyone was cruel. You didn't put the importance on death as it was. It was well, I can't explain it. That's how it was. All of a sudden, in overnight, you become immune to the tragedy of it all. You know, when I look back and think about it. Now, that night, there was a place on the perimeter called East Hill, and it overlooked where they were working on doing the airstrip and evacuating the casualties and everything. And this had been overrun several times by the Chinese because it was a key position for them to fire straight down in the people who were in the location, wounded or laying up in rows waiting to be casualty and things like that. Plus, once they got in, they would be able to get right amongst and cause, you know, well, that would have been it, the finish of everyone. And so this East Hill was a key position. And Baker Troop were called upon to go out and retake the hill because it had been overrun and the Americans had been slaughtered on there, and the Chinese had taken it over and firing down on us. So we put an attack on East Hill, and our orders were from Lieutenant Roberts. He said, "We will do this Royal Marines way." It sounds crazy, but I'm not just bullying the Royal Marines. He said, "We will do it our way," you know, because he said, in other words, we put in an attack and we move in quietly and then surprise them. And we crawled up the sides of this hill round to the right. And back and forth like that was, well, I can't explain it. As well as the tracer, which you see every four bullets, and that was just going like that, there was all other machine gun and mortar fire going on, and we crawled up underneath this to get up to a position to attack the Chinese. And we could hear the Americans screaming out for corpsmen, which is like calling out for the SBA, you know, for the medic, as they're laying there wounded. And we couldn't do anything about it. We crawled up by him, crawled up past him, and just whispered to him, "You'll be all right in a minute," sort of thing. And just before it got light, we put in this attack on the Chinese, and they stopped firing from down below. Obviously, they'd been given a radio message from our signalman. And we put this attack in on the Chinese on the hill, and it surprised them so much that we were able to take the position back on the peak of this hill. All we had was two casualties, and you can see in official reports there was over 500 dead on the front when it got light, and so you can imagine how the Chinese were. We pushed them out of there, foxholes, because they'd literally taken over the American foxholes, and we just had to heave them out. And the enemy as well, as I've said a little while ago, was the cold. Now, within minutes of them being killed, they were frozen solid. They just froze in a position which they were. And so if you had to move a dead chink, whatever, you tipped him over and he went like a piece of wood, literally. And once again, you weren't being heartless. You were didn't even think about it, because all you're thinking of in your mind is survival. And it's not the fact that you're fighting for your country. You're not fighting for a cause. When it's there, you are fighting to survive. And that's the first thing that's in your mind, is to survive. And the other thing that's in your mind is your mate next to you. And this is where the medals are earned. It's not, if I may say so, I don't remember ever being brave and doing a brave thing. You do something instinctively to help your mate, or he helps you. And that is where the bravery is. It's the fact that you are protecting a friend and trying to save him from being hurt, and you're not doing it to win a medal. Can you understand what I mean? I honestly say, my feelings are that everyone who goes to war should be decorated for bravery when they're in action, because there's so many brave things are done which are not done to be brave, that never get seen. I'm not saying the people who get these decorations like the Victoria Cross do not earn them. They are seen to do it, and fortunately it's an instance where they saw that chap do it. Whereas if there's three chaps fighting and two are wounded and that last chap's trying to save him and then he gets killed, then nobody ever knows how brave any of them were. Do you follow me? And this is what you see all in this instances of these things happening. You don't think until afterwards, and afterwards you sit there and you think, oh my, and you start to get a bit of the, you know, shaky sort of thing and trembling, and think, oh my, you know, are you all right, you know, and you say silly things like, you know, you don't realize what you say. You say, I could do with a bloody cup of tea now, you know. And it's really, I think, as you grow older and you look back, you are afraid, but you're trying to cover up that without knowing you're afraid. It sounds a bit crazy, but I'm trying to explain it all. Now, this situation carried on until the 6th of December. And on a couple of occasions, we had much the same thing. I went out with a group of chaps on a tank to retrieve a gun, like a howitzer gun, which had been left on the roadside by the Americans, because the Americans who had got further north were in full retreat, trying to get back to Hagaru to regroup where we were. So in various little places where there was 200 or 300 men, they were all endeavouring to get back into the safety of Hagaru, even though we were surrounded. So, and another thing which I've got to mention, once it got light, you never saw anyone. You get engulfed with the Chinese attacks, literally in masses, once it got dark. The whistles would start to blow, the bugles would be blowing. They blow bugles, you know, they're obviously using them as signals. And suddenly you hear this terrible roar, which is just like anyone else is plucking up courage to charge and shouting, and they come at you in masses in the dark, and you literally firing into hordes of them, and they're falling down, and then another lot are coming, and they're falling down, and another lot are coming, and they come on in hordes of manpower rather than firepower, until they literally overrun you with weight and numbers. We didn't have modern day weapons like today. We had automatic rifles, and I had a what is known as a grease gun, which is a burp gun, which fires a 9mm bullet, and it is very unstable. So most of us just got rid of them and picked up the Garand, which is an American rifle, a Garand. Of course, we were all equipped with American weapons, but we've got rid of some of our own type personal weapons to get one that if fired it, it would still fire in the cold. And also, if it hit somebody, it would just put them right straight down with a big hole in them rather than a light machine gun, which puts about 15 shots into a chap and is still staggering around sort of thing. So you learn in this all the time, and you've got heavy machine guns, which are fine as well by other machine gunners of the Americans. And all this weaponry is being fired into these masses of Chinese as they attack. And that goes on all through the night. Once it got light, they disappear. They've gone, melted back, and a lot of them had these white K-pop type suits, which they just lay in the snow and lay there all day. And you just didn't see them. And so in the daytime, you could move around, apart from snipers, which were sniping here, as I said earlier. But you did not get any mass attacks in the daylight. And we went out on one afternoon to retrieve this howitzer gun, which had gone off the road on the roadside, which the Americans had been bringing back, but had to leave. And we got went out on a tank, and we then came under fire from a machine gun position where the Chinese were waiting for whoever to come to get the gun, you know. And we managed to put the machine gun out of position, out of action, and retrieve the howitzer. We did little jobs like that, which in the daylight, it seemed quite a natural thing to do. And this went on for 5 or 6 days. On another occasion, I helped a chap called Jimmy Stanley, one of our own chaps, who was wounded. And myself and another chap carried him down on a makeshift stretcher off the hillside down into one of the aid tents where they had, you know, doctors and that working sort of thing. And we carried him into the aid tent. And on the way back to go back up to our position, we came across a tiny little groove in the ground. And there was a vehicle there. And there was an American, and it was a filled kitchen, like you see, like a hot dog stand in a lay-by on the main road. And these Americans were there in the middle of this situation, frying up breakfast and whatever. And as we walked by, one of these Americans called out, "Hey, you Brits!" You know, because they recognized us because of all the equipment we had from the Americans –